I'm pleased to have and honored to have in our studio the president of the Farm Foundation, Neil Conklin. Neil, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Dave. Good morning. 4 years ago, as the temperature of rhetoric in the food versus fuel debate rose with the prices of corn and oil, Farm Foundation asked three economists at Purdue University to take a look at the complex forces that were driving food prices. Oil prices aren't at 2008 levels this summer, but drought and high temperatures are pushing corn and soybean prices to record levels, and the temperature of the food versus fuel debate is once again rising. Now as then, Farm Foundation and Purdue University are not about fueling fires. Our shared mission is to be a catalyst for sound public policy by providing objective information to foster a deeper understanding of the complex issues that are facing our food and agriculture system today. So today we are fortunate to have with us three economists from Purdue University, Wally Tyner, Farzad Tahirpour, and Chris Hurt, who have written a paper focusing on the potential impacts of a partial waiver of the ethanol blending rules. We also have with us two respondents, Steve Meyer from Paragon Economics and Vernon Eidman from the University of Minnesota. And they'll be sharing with us their observations on this paper after the presentation by the team from Purdue. So with that, I'll make one observation that perhaps the key to understanding the policy choices ahead of us is to recognize, as the paper points out, that at this point the drought has done its economic damage, and we're not going to be able to reduce the damage, but what we have to look at is how those costs are going to be shared among corn farmers, livestock farmers, taxpayers, consumers, and both at home and around the world. The policy choices ahead of us aren't easy, and our hope here is that this paper can help to provide policymakers and all of the stakeholders in our food and ag system with the knowledge to make these choices informed ones. So with that, I'm going to turn the platform over to Chris Hurt to begin the presentation.
Well, thank you very much, Neil, and if we could cue up our PowerPoint here, we would appreciate getting that started. Let me just set the stage here a bit for what we're going to be reporting on. If we look over the last several years, there's been a very rapid increase in the demand for corn. We've seen from the 05 crop in the United States to the 2010 crop, a 16% expansion in the use of corn. That's also included soybeans, very rapid increase, 14% increase in total utilization of soybeans from the 05 to the 10 crop. Now we have a year, a drought year, a serious drought year. USDA was as high as 14.8 billion bushels of production in their early estimates, now at 10.8 billion, a 4 billion bushel reduction in corn crop. The economics, as is already stated, the damage has been caused by the drought. The National Drought Mitigation Center comes up with estimates of economic damage for weather-related situations. They have, in the last, since 1980, I should say, they have Katrina as the greatest economic damage at $146 billion. But related to our topic today, number two natural disaster from a weather situation is the 1988 drought at $78 billion. This drought is on the magnitude. We don't know if it will end up being somewhat smaller or even larger than the 88 drought. What we're talking about is the second or third largest weather-related natural disaster since 1980 in the United States. This is important. There are a lot of economic damages. What we're going to do is we're going to have a balanced approach here. We're educationally related, as Neil has said, and certainly we're not going to be advocates of any position. So we do know that there are huge impacts from this drought. They extend into many, many areas, including the general economy. But this paper is not about all of those things. What we're trying to focus on in this particular piece of work is the possible impacts if there would be a partial waiver of the renewable fuel standards. And we're certainly not going to be talking about whether we should have mandates from the federal government on ethanol. Okay, if we could move ahead. As we think about the impacts of higher corn prices that we've already seen, roughly 60% up on corn prices since the drought set in, certainly there's going to be major impacts on the livestock sector and all of the products, the meat, dairy, and eggs that come from that sector. High fructose corn syrup, now in most of our soft drinks and food products, all those things that do contain sweeteners that come from corn. It surprises many consumers that when we talk about corn and higher corn prices, it relates to the gasoline pump. Now we have, in most of the gasoline in the United States, 10% is ethanol, and the vast majority of that comes from corn. Certainly, all other food products that contain things from corn starches, corn flour, corn directly, we hear the quotes that over half the products in the grocery store have some connection to corn. And this particular year, what we know is there's not going to be enough corn to go around. And what that means is we're going to have to see reductions among end users. Just to start us on the renewable fuel standard for this year, 2012, that is 13.2 billion gallons of ethanol. That would rise next year to 13.8 billion gallons as the base for ethanol in the conventional category from corn in 2013. There is some flexibility built into that amount. We do have surplus credits or surplus RINs that have been built up, and there are around 2.6 billion gallons thought to be available that could be turned in rather than actually producing ethanol. So this could be a possible flexibility, the use of previous year and current year RINs. And also, blenders can borrow some of those RINs from the future. Now, Wally, we're going to turn it to you to really talk about the economics and some of the technical issues, if this will happen.
Thanks, Chris. The question we're really asking is, what are the possible impacts of a partial waiver? And for there to be impacts of a partial waiver, their blenders need to have positive economic incentives. It needs to be in their interest to reduce ethanol. Otherwise, the waiver has no impact. In recent weeks, ethanol has been priced 25 to 40 cents below the basic standard for gasoline, RBOB, reformulated gasoline. And if that relationship continued, blenders wouldn't have a financial incentive to change from current practice. Ethanol has become an important part of our total system of providing fuel to consumers, and so there would have to be an incentive. Just issuing a waiver wouldn't do it. There has to be an economic incentive for refiners and blenders to change, and that means that corn and ethanol would have to rise in price or gasoline would have to fall substantially to change those basic incentives. However, RBOB's not the only gasoline. Conventional blending stock is also available. It's generally cheaper than RBOB. So what we may end up seeing is some significant regional differences in the extent to which there are economic incentives to change. Next slide, please. In addition to economic incentives, blenders would have to have the capacity technically to change what they're doing. Since around 2008-2009, most of the gasoline, the regular gasoline that you buy at the pump, came out of the refinery as 84-octane gasoline. And it was brought up to 87-octane by blending it with 10% ethanol. Ethanol has a lot higher octane than gasoline, and so refiners were able to produce at a bit lower cost an 84-octane gasoline that they bring up to 87 by using ethanol. So that whole system has changed in the last 4 years or so, and it's not clear how quickly that system could be modified if ethanol blending were partially waived. And it's also not clear if refiners and blenders would want to do it if it were for a one-time waiver. In other words, if they got a notice from EPA that there's going to be a waiver in 2013, but we expect things to go back to normal in 2014, then it's not clear that they would see it in their interest to change that whole system that's been developed over the last 4 years or so. Next slide, please. In addition to the octane issue, there's also a vapor pressure issue. The rules for gasolines and gasoline blends vary by region. They change between winter and summer months. The vapor pressure limit is lower in the summer months because there are potential for more evaporative emissions. But in the summer, 10% ethanol blends have an exemption, a partial exemption, 1 pound per square inch for the vapor pressure limit. So there might be some incentive to continue ethanol for that reason, at least in the summer, even if all the other conditions were met. Next slide, please. And there are other blending issues. Our sense is that if there were a waiver, that what would happen would vary by firm, by refiner, by blender, by region. Valero is one company that owns both oil refining and ethanol plants. Their response might be different from other companies. As I indicated earlier, we have reformulated blend stock, we have conventional blend stock, and then California has its own blending rules and gasoline requirements. So we think that decisions could well vary from one region to another, one sub-region to another, and one company to another. So it's very hard to predict what would actually happen if there were a waiver issued. Also, there are take-or-pay contracts that are part of the way the industry moves ethanol through the chain. We don't think they're terribly large, but they could be a factor also. So what are the possible responses that the industry might make for a partial waiver? So we've broken it down into several possibilities here. The first row is high corn price, oil around 100, with limited refining and blending flexibility. If the refiners either can't or choose not to change their practice, then a waiver doesn't matter. It doesn't have much impact. If we have in the second row the same conditions in terms of prices, but they do have refining and blending flexibility, then a waiver could have an impact. And we're going to talk about in this session both of those cases. The third row is similar to the second, except that a substantial amount of RIN credits are available for use in 2013. So if you had the combination of both RIN credits used in 2013 and an EPA waiver, then the impact might even be larger of a waiver. The next row is high oil price and limited flexibility. In that case, there's hardly any impact of a waiver. And the final one is high corn price, but oil over 120 with flexibility. In that case, it's hard to say, but it's certainly with the high oil price, it's less likely that a waiver would have an impact. Next slide, please. So the bottom line, or what our main point here, is that the determinants of the impact of a waiver depend on these technical and financial incentives. If refiners and blenders cannot change for technical reasons what they're doing now, if the system of using ethanol the way we use it in the entire fuel distribution system is so entrenched that you can't change it quickly or would choose not to change it quickly, then a waiver has very little impact. So in this analysis, that's our sort of first conclusion. If they don't have flexibility, there's very little or no impact of a waiver. But if they do have flexibility, then there is the potential for a waiver having impact. And so in the second part of this paper, we have done a quantitative analysis of what that might be, assuming they do have flexibility. And here we have four cases. The first is the full 13.8 billion gallons for 2013 with no waiver. Then the second case is 2 billion gallons less than that, and essentially assumes that blending credits, prior RINs amounting to about 2 billion gallons, would be used We don't think all of the $2.6 billion would be used. Some might be used in 2012. Some might be carried forward to 2014. So we've done the analysis with 2 billion gallons. Third case is a 25% reduction due to the any combination of waiver and prior credits. We chose that number because 25% is, at least at this point, close to the expected reduction in the corn crop. And the final case is a large waiver. In this case, it's use of all the RINs in 2013 plus a waiver of 3.45 billion gallons. Now I'll turn it over to Farzad Tahirpour, who's going to talk about the quantitative analysis.
Thank you, Wally. I'm reporting the results of the simulation which we made to evaluate impacts of drought on corn production and corn price. We made three different simulations. In the first simulation, we assume corn production will be about 10.5 billion bushels. In the second simulation, we assume corn production will be about 11 billion bushels. And finally, we have a simulation for 11.5 billion bushels of corn production. To evaluate impact of these levels of production, we used a model including crude oil, gasoline, ethanol, EDGS, corn, and soybean markets. The model is used before in several published papers. Next slide, please. In the next slide, you see a table which shows the impact of drought for different cases of waiver. In this table, we have five columns, and we have three cases of a stronger drought, median drought, and weaker drought. The first column is showing expected production before drought. The second column shows drought with 13.8 billion gallons of ethanol production. The third column shows 0.8 billion gallon ethanol production. The next column shows drought with 10.4 billion gallons of ethanol production. And finally, the last column shows drought with 7.7 billion gallons of ethanol. So as you can see in the first row, we have production for different levels of mandate. So when, for example, for the expected production before the drought, there was an estimate for the production about 14.65 billion bushels of corn, and if there is a strong drought, then the total production will be about 10.5 billion bushels of corn. And for this level of mandate, with 13.8 billion gallons of mandate, the corn price will be about 8.75. So if we have medium drought, then the corn production will be about 11 billion bushels, with the price about 7.81 cents, and if we have the weaker drought, then the production will be about 11.5 billion bushels of corn, and the price will be about $7 per bushel. Now, if we waive mandate and we assume ethanol production is about 11 billion gallons of ethanol, then we see reduction in corn price compared to the 13.8, about 7.89 cents. So in general, this table shows that when we give more waivers, corn price is going down. For example, with the drought and 13.8 billion gallons, the corn price is about 8.75, And if we have a and if we have a waiver and we produce about 7.7 billion gallons of ethanol, the corn price would be about 6.58 cents. Now I'm going to the next slide, please. Now we consider waiver impact simulation results a little bit more in detail. Impact of reduced blending to 11.8 billion gallon is around 67 cents per bushel of corn. And that is due to use of RINs. Going from 11.8 billion gallon of ethanol production to 10.4 billion gallons of ethanol production, that reduces corn price another 44 cents to 47 cents, depends on the scale of drought. And then going from 11.8 to 7.75 billion gallons, then we will see a reduction in corn price by about $1.31 to $1.34. So if refiners and blenders have flexibility and use it, the partial waiver impact could be about $1.30 per bushel for a large waiver and about 47 cents for a small waiver. Now I'm going to the next slide. Okay, in this slide, we compare our results with the results obtained by Bruce Babcock. Bruce assumed an average yield of 138 bushel per acre. Ethanol demand structure has flexibility for the first level of reduction in demand. That is, but the demand is inflexible after that range. It gets a corn price reduction of about 91 cents from use of 2.4 billion gallon of RINs, and that is roughly compatible with our RINs results. The waiver after that yields a corn price reduction of about 28 cents due to assumed refining and blending inflexibility. And that is in our interval of $0 to $1.30. Now I'm going to the next slide, please. So here we compare our results with Erwin and Good from Illinois. They do not provide quantitative estimate. They assume the demand would not be flexible after use of available RINs, so they get no waiver impact. And we assume no flexibility, we also get no waiver impact. The degree of inflexibility not known at this time. So now I'm asking Wally to continue, please.
Okay, thanks, Farzad. The, we're going to talk a little bit about the impacts, possible impacts of a partial waiver on the different parties that are affected, and then we'll come to a summary and conclusion. The first part is about the impacts, possible impacts on livestock producers and consumers. As Chris indicated, they face substantially higher feed costs, much of which they can't pass on to consumers in the short run. Ultimately, consumers are going to have to face higher prices for livestock products and other products that use corn and, to some extent, higher fuel cost. Although most farmers have crop insurance, they also face losses. Next slide, please. This slide shows a graph that illustrates sort of an extreme case of zero flexibility in ethanol corn use, and the point it makes is that the adjustment has to occur from livestock producers, exporters, or exports, and a lot of it falls on livestock producers. So it's very clear that in the face of the drought, livestock producers have a lot of adjustment to do if there is no flexibility in ethanol use of corn, and that's perhaps a big if. So let me begin to wrap up, and this is a point that Neil underlined at the very beginning. The economic harm has been done by the drought. The corn price is substantially higher. The losses amount to tens of billions of dollars. And in thinking about a waiver, EPA can't change that. They can't change the loss. They can only redistribute it among the affected parties. Next slide, please. So what are the possible impacts? If refiners and blenders do not have or choose not to use ethanol blending flexibility, a waiver has very limited impact. But to the extent that there is flexibility, either the use of prior RINs or a waiver could reduce the corn price. For the case of prior RINs, our estimate is about 67 cents a bushel. And for a waiver, it could be, for a small waiver, around 47 cents, and for a larger waiver, up to $1.30 a bushel, again, assuming that refiners and blenders have flexibility. Next slide, please. So if refining and blending flexibility exists, a waiver helps livestock producers and consumers, basically sharing the available corn supplies. But a waiver that reduces ethanol production also penalizes corn producers and ethanol producers, and the ethanol producers invested in those plants, assuming that the renewable fuel standard would provide a market or guarantee of a market for their product. Next slide, please. So the waiver decision clearly depends to a large degree on the degree of refining and blending flexibility. It's absolutely critical. And our sense is that EPA needs to do, and I'm sure they will, a very thorough assessment on this issue. If there's no flexibility, if we're sort of locked in to the current technology, or if economically we're locked in, then any waiver decision is more symbolic than anything else. The other main point we're attempting to convey today is that the waiver decision is complicated. What we've tried to do is evaluate the key issues, the key factors that need to be taken into consideration, and to show how the different parties might be affected by a waiver. And we'll stop at that point and look forward to comments and questions.
Okay. Thank you very much, Wally, Chris, and Farzad. That was a great presentation on the paper. And now we want to turn to our two respondents. And let's start with Steve Meyer from Paragon Economics.
Thank you very much, Neil. It is a pleasure to be with you today and to be asked to comment on this this well-done piece of work by the scientists at Purdue. I guess in reviewing the paper prior to the conference, I did find that I felt that this research was well done. You take a look at the issues, and there are a myriad of issues that are involved here with a potential waiver of the renewable fuel standard. It goes to something that I've been trying to deal with for several years now, saying, you know, exactly what does this policy cause when things aren't normal? We've been blessed with pretty good weather for basically 25 years. We really haven't dealt with this kind of drought since 1988, but a few of us have been saying for some time, when this happens, it's going to be extremely painful because by statute, there is limited flexibility here. Now, they have accurately pointed out that there are some sources of flexibility. Those might have been by design. I think most of them are still by luck more than anything. And that was the fact that we do have some reserves of ethanol, larger stocks than normal. We do have RINs that have been driven over the last couple of years that provide some flexibility. Those are all good things. But still, I guess I want to point to the results of the paper that says that if we do provide some sort of a waiver of 55%, we have about a 45-cent reduction in corn prices. And the folks on the ethanol and corn side are quick to say, well, that isn't much, so let's not do it. Well, that 45 cents for a hog producer adds up to somewhere between $2.60 and $3.50 a head, and we kill about 100, we produce about 100 million of them every year. So we're not talking about peanuts here from a general economic impact on the pork industry. If we put the use all the rents and a full flexibility, complete flexibility on the wage, that value goes up by a factor of four. There's real money saved here. The second point I would make is that most people, when they talk about public policy, talk about a sense of fairness and some trade-offs. So far, the livestock and poultry industry have basically done all the giving here, and the corn and ethanol business has done all the taking in this policy since its origination. And I don't think it's unwise or unkind to ask that we have some fairness in this situation that's extreme. The last point I would make is that, we're sitting here at the precipice of a couple of things. First, we had all fresh beef and chicken prices hit records in July already. Neither one of those reactions had to do with this run-up in cost. The beef one is actually the result of the 2007-08 increase in costs and, to a lesser degree, last year's drought, but really that all got started with the 2007-08 increase in cost. The chicken one was first the 2007 and 2008, and then the 2010 run-up in corn prices that caused this one. All of those cost increases on the animal protein side are still ahead of us. And U.S. consumers are going to have, be faced with much higher prices for these products, because the only way at present to satisfy this, reduce supplies and drive prices upward. Now, I think we're going to do that regardless. The question is how much. The last point I would make is that, we have some brinksmanship that's going to play out here as we go through corn supplies for next summer. I would be very shocked if we don't have a situation at some point over the next 6 to 9 months where we get a call from a producer that has no money, has a banker that will not loan them any money, and has a lot full of cattle or a barn full of hogs or a house full of chickens that need feed tomorrow. And it's going to be a pretty bad situation. We had that happen in 2009 and 2010 in a few cases. They were taken care of by various methods. But, this isn't a guarantee that everything's going to be fine in the outcome here and that everyone's going to react in a rational manner between now and then. And so we've made this this bed, and now we have to lie in. Final point I would make is just because waiving the renewable fuel standard now or a portion of that standard doesn't have an impact doesn't mean that it is blame-free in this whole situation. In fact, the rapid increase in the requirements of the renewable fuel standard did paint that guaranteed market that Wally talked about a little bit ago and caused a rapid increase in ethanol supply, one that was far more rapid than we could increase the supply of corn. And so now we've run into a situation where Mother Nature has not cooperated, and we're wringing our hands and saying, well, gee, we never thought about this, when, in fact, we should darn well have thought about it because we've been living on borrowed time for some time. I think the paper is well done. I would not minimize the fact that any reduction in corn prices here can mean a lot to livestock, poultry, and dairy producers in this country.
Thank you very much, Steve. Now let's turn to Vernon Eidman. Vern?
Yeah, I, like Steve, I feel that this is a very balanced report. I think it considers the important factors without overstating what one can say about the impacts at this time, given the information we have available. I feel it's important in any discussion of this analysis to emphasize that rolling back the RFS at this point would not impact corn use for ethanol this year. I think that's important for everyone to understand that it will take more time than that to get the rollback to occur. Given the uncertainty of the corn production estimate for 2012, I think it's important to wait until we have more complete information such as we'll get from the September and the October crop reports, to make any decision on the rollback of the RFS. I realize that has some implications for livestock producers, and I'm not minimizing that, but it's also important to get this right. By October, USDA should have better data on the quantity and the quality of corn produced, including any indications about aflatoxin that may show up later, depending on the kind of weather we have. By then, we'll also know much more about the changes in prices of oil, gasoline, and corn, and also about the profitability of ethanol production. So we'll also know more about, have more information on the flexibility of refiners by that time. So I think until EPA gets a little more information than they have now, it would be a little difficult to move ahead with a rollback in the RFS. So with that, I'll wait and hear what questions we have.
Okay, thank you very much, Vern. And let me tell you, the questions are pouring in. There's no way we're going to have the time to answer all of the questions today, and I might add the quality of these questions is extraordinarily high. So we will do our best to questions that we aren't able to cover on this webcast. We'll do our best to respond to those questions using our Facebook page or our website, our Farm Foundation website, over the next few days. So I'd encourage you to
Yeah, that's true,
keep your
Neil. I just would like to program note to add that this will entire event will be archived up for a full year. So if you have to leave or something or want to come back or ask a question later, there will be the link up there in addition to the video to watch. Should be available within 24 to 48 hours. And I'll turn it back to you, Neil.
Thank you, Dave. Yes, so we do want to keep the discussion going. This is an important issue. I'm going to start with and we've had a couple of different questions come in that are in this same vein for Wally, Chris, and Farzad. What about gasoline prices? What would the effects of a partial waiver be on gasoline prices?
Well, if there's a partial waiver and that results in less ethanol being used or less corn being used in ethanol, that would put downward pressure on the corn price, and that would also put downward pressure on the ethanol price. That's 10% of gasoline, so it's not a huge impact, but it would have an impact.
Okay. Anyone else have any observations on gasoline prices?
And real quick, gentlemen, if you could identify yourselves prior to responding, that would be great.
Okay. Here's one that's fairly quick, and I think I have an answer, but we'll see if anyone else has a better answer. Have you heard any official of any official timeline on EPA's action on a potential waiver of the RFS? And I have certainly not, but I'll ask if any of our panelists have got any better insights into that question.
Well, the answer, direct answer, this is Wally. The direct answer is no, but it would be convenient. Let's say EPA is not obliged to respond quickly, but now that there are four governors that have petitioned, they do have to respond. But they normally would make their decisions for obligated parties in late October, early November. And if they're going to issue a partial waiver, that would be a good time to do it in terms of communicating information to the market in a timely manner. But they're not obliged to do that. So when we say in the paper, if they stick to the calendar and connect a partial waiver with that calendar, that's all we mean. They're not obliged to do it by then.
Okay. Anyone else with a perspective on this? Now, we've received a number of questions and that really deserve some attention, and I'm going to pick on the longer-run implications as opposed to just the implications for that we're looking at in 2012 and 2013. And I'm going to pick just one of these questions because I think it puts the puts a very nice perspective on the longer term issues. In light of the fact that drought, flood, or tornadoes have depressed projected yields in the past, many are suggesting that we should plan for bad weather in the future. If blenders use the RINs this year and next, but we get another natural disaster in 2014, would an EPA waiver or other flexibility scheme that lowers the mandate in times of tight stocks to use have a bigger impact in the future, regardless of the level of flexibility for blenders? Essentially, once we don't have a RIN cushion, how does that change your results in the longer run?
Well, it is a great question, and part of it comes back to how long it takes refiners and blenders to change the current system. When we were in the process of preparing this paper, some of the people connected to the oil industry told us that we're so locked in to the current system that it would take quite a bit of time to change, and implied that we would have to perceive a longer term change in the structure of the industry would be useful before we would make that change. Others said, no, we can change on a dime, and the minute it's economically attractive, we will make the change. So even the shorter term impact certainly depends on those issues, but to a large degree, even the long term do, in the sense that, or medium term at least. So it's not clear that if you just look at, say, stocks to use ratio in June and November, as has been proposed, that refiners could change that quickly or would choose to change that quickly, given that ethanol is so integrated into our refining and distribution and blending system today. So it's also a question that has a great deal of uncertainty attached to it.
Chris? This is Chris. I'll just throw a few kind of general market comments. And what we've experienced over the past 5 or 6 years is that demand for corn that we're talking about here has just simply really outpaced the ability to increase the supply. Now, the RFS, we're already in a period where the rate of growth in the mandate of the RFS has really slowed down. That is, the year-to-year increase has slowed down. And, of course, in the next several years, as we approach 2015, we will be flatlining on that RFS for the conventional ethanol from corn. So I think what we're already seeing is we've really seen a massive response from suppliers of corn growers, to meet this demand. But the point is that our stocks, our inventories, have just been down virtually to nothing at the end of the year. What that means is there's no reserve for some of these uncertainties. I think by 2014, as we look already at perhaps 100 million acres of corn planted next year in 2013, if we can get back to normal production, then we probably have the possibility of increasing stocks levels some. Now, if you have some additional stocks, an extra 500 million bushels, say, of corn, that is more flexibility that's just built into our marketing system. Now, that's not specifically the ethanol side of things, but I think we are overall going to see stocks come up from virtually zero that we've had the last several years.
Let me also shoot a little twist on this to you, Steve Meyer. How about the longer term, the thinking down the road? What are the longer term implications for the livestock sector?
Well, they're not very positive. I mean, to Chris's point, it does. We are catching up to some degree with corn demand by increasing yields every year, but and the chances of having severe shortfalls in corn production, 3 out of 5 years or something like that, are pretty small. We've seen it happen before, though, in 83 and 88, and then 93 we had a flood, and Mother Nature isn't real picky on how she screws things up for us, and so we have to account for that. We're going to reduce these herds.
I don't see any way that we won't reduce the herds across the board. You know, if a higher percentage is used for ethanol, we're going to have we're going to look at all the alternatives that are out there, but those are already all being used as well. They always have been. The question is at what price? And so, you know, we're reducing our ability to produce meat, milk, and eggs and for U.S. and world consumers. And, you know, we have to remember that while it's been touted how the ethanol business creates jobs in communities, if you take equal amounts of the ethanol and put them in pig or chicken production, they create a lot more jobs than a capital-intensive business like ethanol does. And so, you know, I think it's going to be it's a great thing for landowners and those that own ground in rural areas. There's going to be a lot of communities that won't be able to support as many jobs because of the reduction in livestock and poultry production and dairy production in the future.
Thank you, Steve. Now, we all know that anytime you have a policy, you're making a policy decision, there are always going to be those unintended consequences. And we have one of our listeners here who wants to know if those of you on the panel have any insights into what the unintended consequences as they put it, reducing the mandates or a partial waiver of the RFS might have. Let me ask Vern if you would be willing to kick this one off.
Well, I think there are some long run consequences. Been thinking about that as these other questions have come up. Certainly, if you have a law which you enforce, and then you make a major change in that law, then it certainly opens up that possibility in people's minds every time a potential increase in the use of that product, corn in this case, comes up in the future. So I think that's another reason for going at this a little carefully and being sure that EPA has pretty complete information, at least as complete as you can get, before they make a decision on this point. And I think Wally's timeline of waiting till October or so and then putting out the decision is right, even though, as I said, I think that has some bad implications, I know, for livestock producers.
Yeah, and Vern, this is Steve. I would concur. I don't think there's a big rush to get this done. On the livestock and meat side, we'd prefer it quicker than as opposed to slower. But we'd really appreciate it better as opposed to worse. And so, if waiting a month or so gets that done, that's a good thing. We're living proof of the downside of unintended consequences, in my opinion, because, you know, I don't think people really thought this thing through when it went through 5 years ago as to what kind of impact it would have. And if they did, I'd sure like to have talked to them at the time because they had pretty disregard for the impact on the people I work with.
This is Chris. I'll throw out another unintended consequence that we're certainly hearing from some of our corn growers in the Midwest. And that is something economists call demand destruction. And it relates to what Steve has been talking about. And it is the concern that some of our end users in the United States as well as around the country, the higher corn prices go, the more we force some of those sectors to cut back. Now, demand destruction in the long run has some consequences if we return to normal production in, let's say, the whole world for the next 12 months. Then we have fairly large supplies. We have the possibility that we'll be looking at a 15 billion bushel corn crop at this time a year from now with a utilization base at 11 billion bushels, having cut it back so severely. So I think one of the unintended consequences is that we could see a lot of instability, a huge volatility dropping from the highest price ever seen for a U.S. average price for the 12 crop, and the decrease could be the largest we ever have seen for the 13 crop. Anything that tends to moderate prices a little bit for the 12 crop probably helps support later on. So again, I don't think that's an advocacy position, but I think it is something that is an unintended consequence.
Neil, let me also, this is Wally, I think the unintended consequences issue is really an important one, and let me start with perhaps an unintended consequence of the way we're doing this, and that is when you have a fixed demand like a mandate like the renewable fuel standard, that means that it's inflexible, inelastic, as economists say, and so when you have a severe shock, that means that other sectors have to do all the adjustment, or most of the adjustment. The design of the system, having the carry-forward RINs, I think will be a really good feature moving forward, and the possibility of a partial waiver could be useful if and only if, we determine that there's refining and blending flexibility. But now let me talk about a couple of possible unintended consequences of if a partial waiver is issued. One is that we've seen lots of stories. The Secretary General of the Food and Agricultural Organization and New York Times editorials and the like that say that, well, with the stroke of a pen, EPA could reduce the demand for corn for ethanol. What if that's not true and they do it? What if they issue a waiver and it becomes a party that nobody attends in the sense that the industry either cannot or chooses not to, for legitimate economic decisions, not to adjust? Then we will have created expectations that adjustment will occur, and they won't happen. And that also can be disruptive. Finally, another possible unintended consequence of a waiver is longer run in terms of the longer-term alternative biofuels, cellulosic biofuels, in a sense, if EPA does it, they would want to try to ensure that it doesn't set a precedent, because, in a sense, it's very difficult to get investment today for cellulosic biofuels because of a wide range of uncertainties. And if you add government policy uncertainty to that, then it makes it even more precarious. So yes, like any policy, there are unintended consequences in this arena as well.
Okay, thank you very much. You know, we've had a couple of questions that people have asked about that go beyond corn-based ethanol and ask about what's the potential to import some more ethanol from other sources, especially from Brazil, and have you folks looked at all at waiving not the RFS for corn, but the RFS for advanced biofuels?
Neil, this is Wally. Yes, that's a good point. It's in the paper, but we didn't do it in the presentation. It would be sort of an interesting option if EPA chose to waive it's called the other advanced biofuels. That's where sugarcane ethanol is. It amounts to 750 million gallons next year. So the combination of that, and if that were waived, then all the sugarcane ethanol that came in would, in essence, substitute for corn ethanol. And so it would bring about, through market forces, or likely, a reduction in corn ethanol. And it would also reduce the ships passing in the night trade that we're exporting to Brazil, and Brazil is exporting back to us. So it would reduce all the cost associated with that. And Brazil and other Central American countries do have the potential to increase ethanol exports. Brazil, in particular, has the potential to change how much ethanol they mandate be blended. And if they reduce that, then that would free up more ethanol for exports. One question is how quickly they could do that. And we don't know how quickly they could respond. But certainly that policy option of waiving the other advanced is a possibility, and it would have a tint. It would. Our sense is that the impact would be to bring about substitution for corn ethanol and reduce the demand for corn ethanol to some extent.
And the numbers reserves are, I think that's 750 million gallons in the other advanced. That's the equivalent of about 275 million bushels of corn. So, Neil, it is a possible flexibility.
Okay. Thanks for those insights. We have all of us know that the corn milling process has more products than just ethanol. And so here's a question from one of our listeners. I understand that this may be beyond the scope of your analysis, but what would the impact of an RFS waiver be on distillers' grains and soybean meal prices? DDGS and soybean meal are important feed ingredients, and logically their prices would rise if an RFS waiver significantly reduced biofuel production. Everyone's focused on corn prices, but what would the net impacts be on total feed costs?
This is Chris, and I'll get started, and others can chime in. If a bushel of corn goes for ethanol, roughly two-thirds of that is used for making the ethanol, and about a third, around 18 pounds of a 56-pound bushel, is left for feed. Now, to the extent that we have that one bushel that does not go to ethanol, then that is available for other uses. It's you reduce your distillers by 18 pounds that you don't have from that bushel, but you now have three times that amount, 56 pounds, that's available for feed and other uses. So I think if we reduce the amount of corn that goes into ethanol production, that actually makes more available, more corn available. It's less distillers available, but more corn available. What we see is a very strong relationship between corn price and distillers' grains price. Distillers is priced relative to the nutrition that it has. And so it has some protein, it has some energy related to corn and soybean meal. So I think if we saw a reduction in the waiver, reduce the amount of corn that went to ethanol, we would see a lowering of corn price, and we would see a lowering of distillers' grains prices. So I think that direction is different than what Neil said in the question. And Steve, maybe you want to respond.
Well, I think you're true to a great degree, Chris. One of the things we have to recognize is that since late last year, distillers' grains have been deriving more of their value from their protein component than they once did. At one time, they were strictly pretty much used as a super corn, but they do have about 20% crude protein. It's not particularly high-quality protein for monogastrics and for chickens, but because of the run-up in soybean meal prices, that protein component has carried more of the value there. So this question has some merit. I still think it would clearly offset those impacts to leave the corn available for livestock feeders instead of cutting the DDGS. One of the reasons is there are some alternatives on the protein side. We can use more synthetic amino acids and a number of things like that that we really don't have. Again, my point a while ago was, you know, there's only so much other stuff out there, and we've always used it all. It's not as if there's a big pile sitting around that we can now tap because we have to. And so there's some merit to this argument, but I think the net for feed users of corn is that they'd be better off with lower output of ethanol and thus lower output of DDGS.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris and Steve, for those perspectives on the co-products. Let me turn now. We've got time, I think, for one final question, and this is maybe a pretty bottom line one, and it's about retail food prices. What does all this mean at the supermarket over the next in 2012 and 2013? So let's ask for perspectives on that.
Well, this is Chris, and I'll start out. Obviously, while we are saying that the drought is what has caused the economic losses. The distribution of that loss is going to have essentially be passed eventually to consumers of food and fuel products, not only in this country, but since the United States is a very major, the largest supplier of basic food commodities to the world, it's going to be passed to consumers of food and fuel around the world. We just quote USDA numbers. They're looking at something between 3 and 3.5% food inflation this year in 2012, then 3 to 4% increase for next year. Now, what we have is 3 years in a row that where we've seen the food price inflation be higher than the general inflation rate and also higher than incomes have gone up for consumers. We were 3.7% general food price inflation, according to USDA, in 2011. So 2011, 12, and 13, 3 years where we have food prices going up higher than incomes are going up. Obviously, in a wealthy country like the United States, Europe, Japan, that is some redistribution in the family budget to more of their income going toward food consumption and therefore less in terms of all the other things that would be in the expenditure base. Certainly in the world, we hear the concerns of national food agencies that this has been virtually year after year in 08, 9, 10, 11, 12, where we've seen concerns about world food supplies. And of course, it's not just availability, but it's also out in the world for the lowest income people. Price increases are perhaps push more of those populations into poverty. So food prices would moderate, I think, if we can get back to more normality in 2013. And by moderate, the rate of inflation would moderate probably somewhat into 14. But we're going to have implications on the beef side, as an example, right through 2015 on this drought. So the extensions of this drought and how it affects our food supply is actually going to be with us for several years to come.
Vern and Steve, any perspectives on this question?
This is Steve. It's going to cost significantly more money for that subsector of our food that uses these products. I mean, in the short run, I think most people are correct to say that the impact here is not going to be large because there's some corn involved in a lot of things, but there's not a lot of corn involved in a lot of things other than meat, milk, and eggs. And so I think that's where the impact. And we get those watered down and strung out over such long time periods, just as we've seen since 2007, that by the time they hit, everybody's forgot why they hit and why they happened. And, this is going to have a pretty long tail. The last point I would make, Chris, to Chris's point is, this is a distributional issue to a great degree, just like we started off this discussion with. I tell audiences that I speak to that, me and my family have been blessed wonderfully. And, running the price of beef or pork or eggs up probably won't impact how much we eat of those products very much because of that wonderful providence. I go to church with single moms and blue-collar workers that running the price of meat, milk, and eggs up will darn sure have an impact on what they buy and how their families are fed, and in some cases, much to their detriment. We got to remember that it's not. I got a feeling that most people on this conference call today won't have that huge impact on, but there are millions of Americans and millions more worldwide that this is certainly going to have an impact.
Yeah, I would simply. This is Vernon. I would simply add to that and agree that the implications are going to be for the lower income people in our own society within the U.S. And I also agree with the point Chris made. There are going to be some implications for people in developing countries and lower income people in other parts of the world. And I haven't had time to analyze that to know exactly when and where they're going to be. But certainly running up the price of oils and the price of meat and the price of feed in general is going to have some impacts for all of those people. Unfortunately, we don't know as yet what those impacts will be.
Thank you. On that, I think that's a good note to close. We're 5 minutes over our projected time here. I have a stack of questions that we could probably go on for another hour, but we're going to have to close it off now. As I indicated, we will be doing our level best to wade through the stack of questions and to come up with answers, synthesize and come up with a set of answers and tap the insights of the folks on the panel to respond to those really exceptional questions. I think that reflects the fact that we got a tremendous audience and turnout for this webcast today, and it's a measure of the importance of this issue that is in front of us. At Farm Foundation, we certainly want to keep the discussion going. We have now dipped our toes in the water of social media, so keep track of our Facebook page for those of you who are Facebook users, and you will find, hopefully we'll find that we can maintain some of the discussion on this issue through that. So with that, thanks to all of you for attending and participating in this event, and we'll look forward to being seeing you on future webcasts.
Thank you, gentlemen. I just want to thank Neil Conklin, too. Again, this will be archived up for a full year within 24 to 48 hours. There is a question link that will remain on the page. Again, we want to thank Farm Foundation and Purdue University for participating in this. And again, we had quite a crowd online, and we appreciate all your participation. For TV Worldwide, Farm Foundation, and Purdue University, I'm Dave Gardy. Thank you for joining us.